change of season. Indian summer, look around and it's gone. Why you wanna save the best for last? We grow up so slowly and grow so fast. We don't talk about forever. Just catch it where we can on the way alone. If I grab on to the moment, don't let it slip away.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Between war, inequality, biosphere collapse, climate change, and destabilizing advances in technology like AI, humankind is confronted with an almost insurmountable array of challenges. Yet many brilliant experts are working outside the box for solutions, looking to psychedelic-inspired visions of the future to lead humanity through these crises. The book we will discuss today is a collection of interviews with some of the leading minds in consciousness studies, psychedelic culture, anthropology, chemistry, and other disciplines about our origins, our present situation, and the future of humanity and the Earth. Our guest is David J. Brown, author of the book, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity. David holds a master's degree in psychobiology from New York University. A former neuroscience researcher at the University of Southern California, he's written for Wired, Discover, and Scientific American. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including Dreaming Wide Awake, Women of Visionary Art, and Frontiers of Psychedelic Consciousness. He lives in Santa Cruz, California. Well, hello, David, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Thank you, Paul. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, I'd like to start off by just learning a little bit about you, and on a personal level, what initially inspired your interest in the evolution of consciousness?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it's hard to really pinpoint a specific time in my life when that happened. It seems like I've always been interested in dreams and altered states of consciousness, really for as long as I can remember. Back in high school, I started meditating. I took classes in transcendental meditation and began meditating twice a day when I was in high school. And I started experimenting with cannabis and psychedelics when I was around 16. And then spontaneously started having lucid dreams after that, and became extremely interested. My interest was just sort of fueled after the lucid dream experiences. And so I started studying, I studied psychobiology, neuroscience in school, and kept trying to draw the parallels between what was happening in the brain and what was happening in our conscious mind. So it's something that's really, I've been, for as long as I've been an adult and into my childhood, really. I've been interested in the evolution of consciousness and where it's going and how it's evolving.
Okay. And what inspired you to conduct the interviews featured in this book?
You know, with the exception of my book, Mavericks of Medicine, and my book, Women of Visionary Art, all of my interview collections were really inspired by the same thing that inspired my very first book, Mavericks of the Mind, which was philosophical questions like, what is reality? What is your concept of God? What happens after we die? These were questions that my girlfriend at the time, Rebecca McClendon-Novick, who I did Mavericks of the Mind with, began having late night philosophical discussions. And we thought, wouldn't it just be wonderful to ask some of the great minds on the planet what they thought? And that was what began this interview process. And the latest collection is really no different. Even though it focuses on, you know, artificial intelligence and the singularity and its interface with psychedelics, it was really inspired by, you know, the people that I find most interesting, the people whose books I've been reading at the time. And there's a really wide, you know, cross-section of different types of people from, you know, as you mentioned, from different scientific fields and the arts and even comedy and performance, because I saw a resonance and a compatibility in their different ideas that I wanted to try to bring together. And also people that I have a positive or optimistic view, I think is important to broadcast their ideas and you know, help to balance the enormous amount of pessimism that we find in our world today.
Well, you know, it's interesting to try to decipher the positivity from the book. You know, it's such a quest for so many of us these days to, you know, find a reason to be hopeful and see what's happening as meaningful. Okay, let's talk about the book's title. It links psychedelics and the singularity. And I don't know that very many people in our audience know what the singularity means, but let's define these terms. First of all, what is psychedelic these days? You know, there's so much happening under that rubric. And I'm wondering how you would define a psychedelic drug. I mean, is it MDMA? Is it ketamine? Is it, you know, where do we draw the line for that categorization?
Yeah, well, I really like, I like the original term psychedelic more than entheogen and more than hallucinogen and more than some of the other terms, because I think it has the widest variety of meanings that could apply to it, which means psychedelic means mind manifesting. So it amplifies whatever is going on in the mind. Stan Grof, psychiatrist, defined it as a non-specific brain amplifier. And I think that's really the best definition for a psychedelic there is. And when I refer to psychedelics, I'm generally referring to the classic psychedelics, or, you know, the LSD, psilocybin, DMT, mescaline, are the classical psychedelics that have the longest history of recorded use with great safety. And then there are, of course, you know, drugs like MDMA and ketamine, which have certain psychedelic properties, but don't seem to fall into the same, you know, category of safety and reliability in producing, you know, accessing the unconscious like the classical psychedelics do.
Uh-huh. And how do you think psychedelics have affected human culture and raised ecological awareness?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, I worked with MAPS for 5 years, and I was really excited to be able to see that psychedelics are finally not being criminalized, demonized, ridiculed, and ignored by the mainstream media, and that they're finally being taken seriously, and their influence in terms of helping with mental health problems, with post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, helping with addiction problems and end-of-life anxiety, I think it is really, really wonderful. And I think the most important thing, though, that they, you know, even though I'm, and even the more, you know, far out research, like the DMT extended state research, which we can talk about more later, but I think the most important thing that psychedelics do is they raise ecological awareness, or are our consciousness of the environment and our way we relate to the natural world and our sensitivity and our interconnection, and breaks down the boundaries between between ourself and our environment. And I think that there's just simply nothing really more important right now than the role that they're playing in raising ecological awareness because of the environmental crisis that we're facing right now, and with global warming, and the may only have a few decades at most left to turn things around before we're facing, you know, what could be the end of human civilization. So I see psychedelics as being kind of almost like an evolutionary catalyst, you know, or something that's been, you know, almost released by the Gaian, the Gaian matrix that governs the intelligence on this planet, as a way of helping to balance the selfish intentions of human beings that are getting us out of control and destroying, you know, toxics in the ocean and radiation in the air, and it's just a absolute catastrophic calamity that we're facing right now. So I don't see anything more important than raising ecological awareness, and I think psychedelics are the key to doing that, because nothing really does it in such a small amount of time, like Scrooge in the Christmas Carol, where it can just happen overnight.
I've had personal experience with psychedelics, actually quite a bit. Most of it when I was in my 20s, but I can remember taking LSD and climbing a hill, a mountain, and just feeling the whole thing breathing. The whole thing was alive. You know, it was, nature was so alive, and I felt so connected to it. So I can really relate to that experience and how that's going to support the environmental consciousness.
Now, many people who are environmental activists, you know, talk about how their psychedelic experience was instrumental in bringing that together. So, yeah, so it's really been very, very helpful in that respect. And as you say, you know, the most commonly reported thing that people say about a psychedelic experience is everything is alive. Everything seems alive.
Right. Well, what about the coming singularity? What on earth does that mean? Can you explain the concept of the singularity?
Yeah, the singularity is a term that was borrowed from astrophysics. In astrophysics, it basically means the point in the center of a black hole, or what existed before the Big Bang, where all the known laws of physics break down and future predictions can't be made. It's a term that's been borrowed from that by Ray Kurzweil. It was popularized by Ray Kurzweil in a technological sense to apply to how computer intelligence has been exponentially increasing in computational power ever since the 1990s. And many people were very skeptical of his projections about where artificial intelligence was going to be going back in the 1990s. And he predicted that artificial general intelligence, or the when computer intelligence pretty much is equal to about the as smart as the average or smartest human being, would be happening by the 2020s, the end of the 2020s, which is where we are now. And it seems like it's a pretty accurate prediction. I was just reading this morning about how AI programs are now designing AI programs. So this creates a sort of positive feedback loop where they're going to get smarter at an even more rapid exponential growth rate. And if this keeps happening, what will happen eventually is that they'll become smarter than all human beings combined. And that's what Kurzweil and others have referred to as the singularity. And because there's beyond that, we can't really predict what happens next. So like in physics, this is it's sort of a poetic metaphor for where we're headed. And I try to link the two, you know, psychedelics and the singularity together, because I think the psychedelic renaissance, bringing out what I was talking about earlier about how ecological consciousness and awareness is so important, is, I think, a really very, very important balance for what's happening with artificial intelligence, because there are inherent, you know, dangers and perils that could be happening with it as well. It could be our own undoing. It could be as dangerous as nuclear weapons, as many people have said, because we just can't predict where it's going to go. And the initial conditions in which these things are programmed could have consequences that are, you know, that are deadly to us. So I see the two coming together, psychedelics and the singularity, to balance one another and to help guide us and navigate us into a more hopeful and positive future.
You know, it's so befuddling to think that the way that we design artificial intelligence systems or support them is so critical to the decision making that's going to happen with their help downstream. Because I know sometimes I think artificial intelligence, geez, that's our only hope. It's like these problems that we've created, we don't have the brain, we don't have the brain power to, it's like Einstein said, you can't solve the problem with the same level of intelligence that created it. And so we need a higher level of intelligence. But I wonder, and there was some discussion in your book about this, I don't remember which one of your experts was saying this. It's like, you know, is artificial intelligence, it's not human. Is it ever going to be able to, you know, what about intuition? What about, what about creativity? What about creative decision making? Now, unless you tell it what the values are that, you know, it should use as a criteria for decision making, you know, I don't know. It's exciting.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the things like creativity and intuition, I think there might be some surprises in store. I mean, the game AlphaGo, or the program AlphaGo, which, you know, was it came up with what seemed to be intuitive approaches towards the game that people had always said would be impossible for a computer to do, and computers have already been writing, you know, poetry and music that many people actually do find creative or deeply moving. So I think that as the computational power increases, I think there may be some surprises in store, because in many ways our own brain is just, it works in a digital fashion, and it's mimicking very well the processes that our own brain, they're based on neural nets and the way that our brain processes information. So who knows, but I think that there may be some surprises in store.
Interesting times, as the ancient Chinese proverb. So what do you think?
I thought that was a curse, actually. But
that was a curse. What do you think about the philosophical idea that reality is some kind of simulation?
Yeah, that's one of
all the people in your book, and I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, that's a question that I've thought about quite a bit. Yeah, I did run that by almost everybody that I interviewed in the book. It's a concept that was developed by the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom a while back, and it basically proposes that, you know, the possibility that, you know, that all of what we think of as material reality could be, you know, could be a computer simulation of sorts. And the evidence for this idea is that we already have with our development of virtual reality just over the past few decades. It's the resolution has increased and the immersibility of it has increased, and it's getting pretty close to being indistinguishable from what we experience as material reality. So if we, you know, just carry this even just a few decades into the future, it almost will be, you know, with brain implants and the acceleration of artificial intelligence, it will become indistinguishable from what we call material reality. So if we ourselves are close to this process, then civilizations that are more advanced than us, hundreds of years, thousands of years more advanced than us, surely they have already come up with this technology. So could we possibly be living in a simulation? Many people, you know, also, you know, draw evidence from what they call the mandala effect, you know, the fact that people have conflicting memories with what things that have happened in the past that they swear have happened. And this sort of dovetails with the idea of the Matrix films, where this idea was popularized. So it's something that a lot of people who have done psychedelics seem to feel that they get evidence for this computer simulation that we're living in. And whether or not, you know, we're living in a computer simulation, we're certainly living in a simulation of sorts, in the sense that, you know, what we think that we're looking out through our eyes as though they're, you know, windows into the world. And in fact, what they are is they're collecting light waves and translating them into neural impulses that reach our brain. And then our brain creates a model or a quote unquote simulation of reality. And what we're living in is a simulation of that, whatever it is that our, you know, our eyes are picking up on. So we're not really looking out at the world. We're looking into our own brains, you know, at the model of reality or the simulation that we're creating for ourselves. And possibly, you know, we could be a simulation within a simulation. So, so it's certainly an intriguing and wonderful philosophical idea to contemplate, and that's why I asked many of the people that I interviewed about it in my new book.
And you also ask just about everybody about DMT and alien contact. And before I ask you about that in general, I'm wondering, you must have personal experience with DMT, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's what influenced my curiosity in it. I first experienced DMT back in 1983. Somebody turned me on to it, and I had, should I talk a little bit about what DMT is first, so people understand? DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is a substance that's naturally found in the human brain and in all mammalian brains and all throughout, actually, the human body. There's no direct evidence of the human brain, but it's found in other mammalian brains. We suspect it in the human brain, all throughout the plant world, all throughout nature. And no biochemist can tell you what function it serves or what it does. But we do know that when you ingest it in a, you know, high enough quantity, that you know, it's an order of magnitude more intense as a psychedelic than psilocybin or LSD generally is, and it can transport you to another world, to a completely immersible multidimensional world that replaces our three-dimensional reality, and it's populated by these other entities, seemingly intelligent entities.
You've experienced interaction with these entities.
Yeah, so in my personal experience, I, you know, experienced these palatial elves, and I had a giant mantis being of some kind, you know, doing some kind of experimentation on my brain and rewiring my brain in different ways. And you know, when I came out of that experience, it seemed, you know, absolutely more real than real, not like a hallucination or, you know, not like a dream. It had a sense of objective reality to it. So I've taken this, you know, the possibility very seriously. And it's why it's explored by the, you know, the people in my book, Andrew Gallimore and David Luke, who's running studies in at the Imperial College in London to put people into extended states to see if they can have longer periods of contact with these different entities. And my latest book, which I don't know if you know, was just published, the Illustrated Field Guide to the DMT Entities, which is an attempt to create a you know, in the spirit of the old, you know, field guides to reptiles and amphibians and different types of natural species. We look to try to categorize, create a taxonomy of the different DMT beings that people have reported, the octopoid beings, the reptilian beings, the self-transforming machine elves that Terrence McKenna talks about. We did little profiles, and I had Sarah Finn Huntley, the artist I worked with, did illustrations of the different entities, and we had other artists, Alex Gray and Luke Brown and others, create different entities for the book. So people are, you know, people are really taking this seriously now, and it's now become, you know, quite a huge phenomena. There are, you know, if you do a Google search, there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of reports now of people reporting these entity contact experiences, and strangely and synchronistically, it dovetails with the leaked Pentagon, you know, coverage of footage of UAPs and UFOs and the reports from government officials about you know, reverse technology with alien crash vehicles and things like that. So it seems like people are becoming really open to this idea that we could be creating a technology to communicate with advanced aliens or entities from elsewhere.
Wow, that's, you know, fantastic stuff. I mean, I know ayahuasca is a way to consume DMT in a more lengthy manner, and I've taken ayahuasca several times, but I never really saw any entities. I saw a lot of patterns and things, but so I haven't had that experience. And like you say in the book, there's this new technology for extending the DMT experience. So maybe we'll learn something by that. So, you know, what I'm curious, we're quickly running out of time, and I want to know what did you learn? Did you learn anything from? I'm sure you did. What did you learn from doing all these interviews with these people on these topics?
Well, you know, I get asked that question a lot. I don't know that I really actually have something specific that I could say I learned, because I interviewed these people because I had already read their books and I had a pretty good idea of, you know, of what, you know, what to expect. So there wasn't really a whole lot that I actually learned other than, you know, than getting a great sense of optimism, you know, and hope about the future was, I think, the most important thing.
Yeah, no, that is beautiful. Now, you bring up in the book the problem of consciousness. And of course, this is the elephant in the room about everything. You know, it's like, as you put it, the most interesting unsolved problem in the world, and you've kind of dedicated your life to that, to understanding that. What can you share with us about what are we learning about the nature of consciousness these days?
Well, I think that as you say, it's the greatest mystery in science. When I was in graduate school, you know, they basically put consciousness into two categories. You're either conscious or you're unconscious. And, you know, and it wasn't really until, you know, David Chalmers came along, the philosopher I interviewed in my book, who really brought attention to the scientific fields that, you know, that just the subjective experience of experiencing the world is really the greatest mystery, you know, that we're facing in science. And I'm glad to see that it's finally being taken seriously. I think the most important thing that we're learning right now with consciousness really has to do with how we can alter it and how we can change it, how we can expand it and how we can manipulate it with psychedelics and possibly with other brain technologies. So I see a time coming in the near future when we'll be able to dial and tune different brain states with these different technologies, and possibly discover through artificial intelligence new types of psychedelics that can produce states of consciousness that we can barely imagine right now. There's also great research going on with lucid dreaming, where they've been able, through transcranial electrical brain stimulation, been able to induce lucid dreaming states on command. So I see that as another valuable adventure that we're headed towards.
You know, there's so much that we could explore, and I want to thank you for being with us, but we pretty much run out of time. And I want to make sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.davidjbrown.com. That's all one word, David J. Brown, J-A-Y. And for those who may have tuned in to Pathways late today, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play and or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with David J. Brown, author of Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity, a fascinating read, interviewing some of the most intelligent minds around. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday morning at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. And even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, That's DIVINation.com, as well as via iTunes, Paulo's YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to David J. Brown and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Supported community radio.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights,